I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
That's right, folks, we're returning to subject of the DC Foreign Policy Blob on this edition of Parallax Views with not one, but two guests, two interviews. First up, Trita Parsi, the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, on why we need a drastic change in U.S. foreign policy towards restraint rather than militarism and economic warfare. Then, Nadia Ahmad, a law professor at the Berry University School of Law, joins us to discuss her op-ed for Common Dreams entitled "The U.S. Endgame in Afghanistan Was Mineral Extraction, Not Democracy." That's going to be later on this edition of Parallax Views, but first, let's get to our conversation with Trita Parsi. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I am very pleased to have on, the co-founder of the Quincy Institute and vice executive president of the Quincy Institute, Trita Parsi. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm really glad we could make this happen. I guess the first question I wanted to ask you before we get into Afghanistan and the forever wars and you know what's been in the news lately is what led you down the path of a foreign policy focused more on restraint?
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for asking that question, because gives me an opportunity to explain why I think it is so needed. I've been working on U.S. foreign policy for roughly 15, 16 years at the time, primarily in the Middle East, primarily on U.S. and Iran, and had played a vocal role, at least in terms of pushing for the JCPOA, the Iran deal, and was quite distraught rather soon after the deal was struck, in the sense that I was worried that whether it would be Hillary or Trump coming in, the instincts I saw in Washington was such that the JCPOA, we wanted to keep it, but we were going to try to keep it while doubling down on a lot of problematic relationships in the Middle East. For instance, one person from the Democratic establishment said that we should now compensate the Saudis for having struck the JCPOA, which to me sounded so bizarre, because the JCPOA lied in our national interest, and we don't have to compensate anyone for doing something, particularly an agreement that was approved by the UN Security Council 15-0 and had very, very broad support in the world. It was essentially only three countries that opposed it. But to me, it sounded not only bizarre, but I was realizing that the JCPOA was increasing the contradictions of our US, of our policy in the region. And the more I thought about it, I also realized it's actually a bigger problem than that. The JCPOA was in contradiction of our grand strategy, because we have a grand strategy. We don't talk about it. It's essentially the water we swim in. But it's a grand strategy of liberal hegemony, the belief that we make ourselves safe by dominating the world militarily. And that if we don't do this, if we don't order the world, there will be chaos. There's no alternative to American leadership. It's only chaos. And this leads us to a situation in which we are, you know, having 850 or so military bases around the world, the massive militarization of American foreign policy. It also leads to a situation in which every country that is not a pliant democracy is by definition viewed as a threat, because we need to constantly change governments in other countries in order to make them pliant. Otherwise, the cost of our domination will be too high. Within that context, a JCPOA, an agreement that is negotiated with several different countries, that is based on a compromise in which no military force is used, is actually a contradiction of that grand strategy. Staying in Afghanistan for another two centuries with absolutely no plan whatsoever would not be a contradiction of that grand strategy. And it led me to a belief that we need to address the water we swim in. We need to deal with that issue, because if we don't, we can end up winning very important victories such as the JCPOA, but they will probably not be able to endure, because they cannot live in a strategic vacuum. They need to live within a grand strategy that actually protects and nurtures them rather than essentially suffocates them.
I was going to ask in that regard, do you think that the tide is turning on foreign policy in the U.S.? I talk a lot on this show about the foreign policy blob, as Ben Rhodes called it, during the Obama administration. But I know that your work has received accolades from the late Zbigniew Brzezinski. I know that your PhD advisor was Francis Fukuyama, who I think has actually been more self-reflexive about U.S. foreign policy. Do you think people are coming around, at least in part, to some of our views?
I think you're quite right. There is definitely a momentum for restraint right now. And I think it's due to several different reasons. First of all, you have a crisis of liberal hegemony because it had so clearly failed. And as a result of that, even those who have been supportive of it, those who are self-reflective, recognize that there is a crisis and that there's a failure that needs to be addressed. That does not necessarily mean that they're shifting towards restraint. It means that they're at least admitting that their own previously preferred route has not succeeded. And that in and of itself is important, not sufficient, but important. But you do have other factors that I think is raising the profile of restraint. One, you have a younger generation, Gen Zs and millennials, who have grown up understanding that several unnecessary wars of the United States and over-militarized foreign policy is the leading cause as to why their standard of living is not going to be as high as that of their parents. They are not buying into American exceptionalism in the same way. They are willing to question those things. They openly disagree with it in a manner that just didn't happen with the two previous generations in the same way. Moreover, you have the rise of progressives within the Democratic Party, and they are explicitly against the current foreign policy. They may not all be in agreement with what it should be replaced with, whether it's a progressive foreign policy based on values or if it's something that is more based on restraint. But at a minimum, I think they do reject the idea that the United States needs to dominate the world, that, you know, hegemony is the same thing as leadership. They reject that. And that is a very significant development as well. So all of these things coming together, I think, have led to a situation in which, and let me add another thing. We usually say that foreign policy doesn't win you elections, but a really thoughtless, mindless, militaristic foreign policy does cause you to lose elections. And that has now become quite clear in the last presidential elections. I mean, Donald Trump did not invent the anti-war sentiments of the American public. He was, however, willing to channel it. He was willing to embrace it and use it for his own purposes, needless to say. But nevertheless, he was willing to do that in a way that many previous candidates, certainly on the right, had not done, except for Ron Paul. And we've seen that also with the Democrats, how that has also become a very important factor there. I mean, in the last round of primaries, once the first couple of candidates were out, they were all you know, almost competing with each other about who would bring home more troops from the Middle East. That is quite a significant development.
Now, with regards to where we're at now, you recently wrote a piece for the National Interest entitled U.S. Military Domination Has Been Disastrous for the Middle East and America. I think my listeners are familiar with how disastrous it has been for the Middle East, but why has it been disastrous for America?
It's been disastrous for the United States because it has not made us more safe. It has militarized our foreign policy, which has then also colored our domestic politics. Everything from the militarization of the police, these factors cannot be disconnected from our broader foreign policy. Moreover, the favorable position of the United States geopolitically, which we all knew was not going to be enduring. At the end of the day, that's the nature of power. It is cyclical. Other countries would be rising. But the speed in which we have lost our privileged position as one of the most powerful states in the world has been significantly increased, sped up by these unnecessary, strategically unwise military interventions in the Middle East. You know, we've spent more than $6.4 trillion on the war on terror. That has caused us to kill roughly twice as many people as the terrorists killed during that period. Imagine where we would be today if those $6.4 trillion had been invested in green technology, other things that could truly have boosted America's global leadership and raised the standard of living of people here, rather on all of these endless wars that at the end of the day were not a development program for nation building in Afghanistan. It was a development program for nation building in Northern Virginia, where all the defense contractors are situated. I live here myself, and I can see the exponential growth of swimming pools and other things that have been popping up here in the last 20 years. That money came right back here, not to those countries and not to the broader American public.
Now, I know a lot of pundits now, a lot of talking heads are saying, look at what has happened when we left Afghanistan. We're leaving now and it's in chaos. And look what we've done. Don't we have a responsibility to Afghanistan? I view us as having sort of created a lot of chaos in not only Afghanistan, but the Middle East more generally. What do you say to these pundits and talking heads that are saying, oh, this proves us right, we need more interventionism?
The only reason why it looks the way it is because of our interventions at the end of the day. And it's not just the United States. Look, Afghanistan has been the arena for interventions by the Soviets, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, and the United States for the last 40 years. I'm not saying it was paradise before, but you cannot have four decades, five decades of these type of interventions by these major powers, superpowers who have used Afghanistan as the arena to score their own points and fight their own battles, and then expect the country to be able to be functioning and certainly to benefit from it. But then it also comes to another question, which is capacity and intent. Even if some of these people would have genuine intent and they genuinely feel like, look, we ruined these countries, we have to do something. Now we have to intervene to fix them. We first intervened to destroy them, or at least that's the result. Now we have to do it to fix them. I'm still skeptical of that because even if the intent is good, I have significant question marks about the capacity of the United States, the competence of the United States to do a good job when it comes to this, the nation building. It's not just whether we want to do it, whether we truly have that intent. Even if we were absolutely, if we were just a nation of Mother Teresa's, I do not believe that we have the capacity. Let me give you an example. When the Soviets occupied northern Iran during the Second World War, they prepared themselves by sending in a vanguard prior to that invasion, or that occupation wasn't much of a military invasion. Guess who they sent in? They didn't send in spies or counterterrorism or, you know, they sent in cultural anthropologists to map out Iranian society, understand its political culture, understand its centers of power in order to minimize the inevitable tensions and problems that comes with an occupation. This is, by the way, not a defense of their occupation. I'm just trying to explain the difference in methodology. Compare that to the very explicit nation-building invasion of Iraq, in which 3% of US officials that were sent to Iraq actually spoke Arabic. We didn't even try nation building. We tried a talking point about nation building. That's the extent that we did it. 2% of the money that went to Afghanistan actually went for economic development. 2%. So after 20 years, my answer is you had your goal. Enough. We don't have the competence. We frankly don't have the intent. To me, I fear the argument that we should stay on to fix it is just another excuse, yet another lie to make sure that we can stay there for another two decades.
And I was going to say, I think it's been very dishonest of certain people to try to, I think there's conflation between criticizing maybe the exit strategy and then using that criticism to say, oh, we should stay there. I think that's been horrible to see people make that argument. Another thing I wanted to touch on just briefly, because I think it's a misunderstanding I've seen people have about Quincy. I've had people say, oh, Quincy, they're just against the wars, but they're for these other forms of intervention probably still, right? Like sanctions and economic warfare. But I think Quincy is very critical of that as well.
Oh, certainly. We're actually coming out with a study about the significant dangers of broad-based sanctions and the economic warfare that it is. We're challenging very much this common notion in Washington that sanctions is an alternative to war. On the contrary, sanctions is just an alternative form of war. It is not a peaceful option. In many cases, sanctions have actually been more devastating than warfare itself has been because of the very blind and collective way that it targets countries. Two of our non-resident fellows wrote a fantastic piece, Asli Bali and Aziz Rana, that showed that in many ways, sanctions are more devastating to the civilian population because there are laws of war. You cannot bomb civilian infrastructure in a war. Unfortunately, countries do that, but there's laws of war that at least limit some conduct in a war. There is no such body of laws of economic warfare. And as a result, broad-based sanctions specifically, deliberately target civilian infrastructure, destroy civilian institutions, which then can lead to the collapse of state starvations and all kinds of other problems. The State Department itself did a study, I think it was in 2004, trying to explain why was it so difficult to govern Iraq after the invasion and occupation of Iraq. And one of the chapters dealt with the impact and the legacy of roughly a decade of very, very broad-based economic sanctions. I actually used to work at the UN Security Council and I was on the committee that had to approve what goods the Iraqis could buy. And I remember very clearly how both toilet paper and lipstick was identified as dual-use technology and as a result would be sanctioned. Well, the results show that the sanctions had actually shrunk Iraq's economy to roughly $16 billion. And what that does then is that the incentive structure of ordinary people changed dramatically. When you have an economy that has been so crushed, suddenly people didn't have an incentive to send their young girls to school to learn how to read and write and get educated because there was no prospect for them to do anything in that economy. So you actually saw a significant drop in literacy rates, particularly amongst women. Now you tell me, is that a pathway towards building a democracy? Actually having a higher degree of female illiteracy? That is what sanction does. And it's more invisible. You don't see it the same way as warfare does. So no, we're extremely critical about the way that the US government has been using sanctions because it's actually become a tool for warfare. And also research does show clearly when you go down the path of sanctions, you actually increase the likelihood of warfare because of a variety of factors, one of them being that it becomes an escalatory cycle. And after you run out of sanctions options, you've kind of cornered yourself and then you have to take military action. And precisely because we believe that it's critical that the United States puts forward much clearer bars, a much higher bar for when it would use military action, we see a major problem with the economic sanctions policy as well, not only because of the unnecessary and blind suffering it imposes, but also because it increases the likelihood that the U.S. will end up in war.
And I was just going to add to that, I think a lot of these actions that we're talking about, a lot of these interventions, and maybe this is the note we can start closing on, is, you know, if we're against, you know, things done in other countries, like Iran, I don't see how sanctions are actually going to get the people of those countries on our side. I mean, I think a lot of what we do actually emboldens support for hardliners.
Oh, it certainly does. And we've seen that in numerous places. I would say Trump sanctions on Iran is a key factor as to why Raisi got elected in Iran, this hardline candidate. There's other factors. I mean, the hardliners were rigging that election without a doubt. But when you take a look at the numbers, you see that what really happened there is that because Trump walked out of the nuclear deal, it just destroyed the credibility of the reformist in Iran who had argued that Iran's political economic situation can be massively improved if it comes to terms with the United States. And then that was not only disproven by Trump in the sense that he withdrew from the agreement, but the main argument the hardliners used against the reformists was to say, this is not Trump's fault as much as it is your fault because you did not have a plan B. You actually trusted the American side. If the hardliners had done the deal, we would have had a plan B and a plan C. And that was not enough necessarily to convince a lot of reformers to go and vote for Raisi, but it was enough to convince the reformers not to vote at all. And that's why you had very low participation rate, but the number of votes that Raisi got was higher than it was in the elections 4 years ago.
So closing comment here, I just wanted to ask you briefly, I know that Quincy has been attacked a lot increasingly in recent months with people throwing this snarl word of isolationism at it. How do you respond to people that say, those of us who want a more restrained foreign policy are just advocating for isolationism and going away from engagement with the world? Because I don't think that's what we want.
I think it is an absolutely fascinating and self-revealing accusation to say that if you actually want to have a more restrained foreign policy, you don't want to go to war all the time. That means you're an isolationist. Because what it reveals is that these people then believe that our engagement with the world is us bombing other countries. If that is your definition of engagement, well, then that may explain why we're in such a bad situation in our foreign policy. That is not our engagement, our idea of engagement. Our idea of engagement is that we should be diplomatically far more involved than what we are right now. You know, the real withdrawal of the United States is not a military withdrawal. It's the diplomatic withdrawal that we have made. There's so many countries in the Middle East, for instance, that we can't talk to. That's why the Russians are much more effective. They can talk to everyone. We can't. We don't, because we have pursued this militaristic foreign policy. So it's actually their policies that are the ones that stops engagement with the rest of the world. It's because when the minute the bombs drop, that's when we have the end of actual engagement. And they are the ones who are constantly favoring military solutions to problems that actually don't have a military dimension to begin with.
I have to be honest. I always thought, you know, I feel like we're living in a bizarro world when people say that the people who want to bring back the diplomatic toolbox, a toolbox that I think we've forgotten too much, we're being accused of isolationism. But really, you know, it seems like we should use diplomacy first before we go to war. It seems like using war first is the most insane thing you can do.
But throwing out such a bizarre accusation, as you correctly points out, I think reveals something else as well. For so long, the proponents of these policies have had such a dominant position in Washington, in the broader debate, that they never had to defend themselves and their plans. In fact, the lack of accountability in Iraq and Afghanistan are examples of that. Now we're in a situation in which they do, because restraint is rising, it has made political inroads. And now when they actually have to defend themselves, lo and behold, turns out they're really bad at it. And as a result, they very, very quickly resort to accusations, silly accusations, bizarre accusations, such as isolationism, because they frankly don't know how to defend their policies.
I wanted to end on a positive note. I think we're, as you pointed out earlier, seeing a rise in restraint, not just on the left and the progressive side of things where I'm at, but also on the right. But what hope do you have for the future? Do you think there could be a new Iran deal? Anything hopeful you can say in closing?
My biggest hope right now in the immediate term is that the president draws the conclusion that not only did he do the right thing, he needs to continue to do this, not just in Afghanistan and elsewhere. The logic that he put forward for why we need to leave Afghanistan is equally, if not more, applicable to Iraq. And then with that withdrawal, we need to fundamentally rethink our policy towards the Middle East as a whole. At the same time, my big worry, if there's one thing I really worry about, is that instead of viewing these withdrawals and this right sizing of our military footprint as opportunity that should be replicated elsewhere in the region and lead to a fundamentally new approach to the world, that it will only instead just be used to move troops from the Middle East and place them in Asia in order to engage in some form of a Cold War or confrontation, great power competition with the Chinese. I think that would be very unfortunate, because I think we have an opportunity to do something much smarter than that. So that remains to be seen. So there's both hopes, opportunities, but there are also some very significant risks.
I want to thank you again, Trita Parsi, for taking a little bit of time out of your day to speak with me and my audience at Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Please go to quincyims.org. You can also go to my own personal website, tritaparsi.com. And of course, go to Twitter. All of our researchers and experts are on Twitter. I'm at tparsi.
Welcome to Parallax Views. Nadia Ahmed, author of the article at Common Dreams, entitled "The U.S. Endgame in Afghanistan Was Mineral Extraction, Not Democracy." How are you doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing well. But the situation on the ground in Afghanistan is really a disaster, and we're seeing our worst worries play out right now.
So before we get into the current situation in Afghanistan, you write in your article, we shouldn't ask what went wrong when it comes to the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. We need to ask what could possibly have gone right. What do you mean by that framing? I'm just curious for my listeners that may be only just beginning to think about these things.
Right. And so I think for me, this the 9/11 was my Vietnam, in the sense it was an issue that motivated me to get involved with political activism in ways I hadn't before. And I saw the cycle of violence that was occurring leading up to 9/11 and afterwards was something that we could have foreseen. And because of our history of U.S. involvement in other countries, in terms of countries where we have occupied and invaded other countries, whether it's in Latin America and in Southeast Asia. And so we should have anticipated what happened when we first went in. It wouldn't be something where we can go in as a foreign occupying force and walk away. So I think there was the history of past U.S. involvements. And then on the other side of it, we also saw the history of foreign invasions in Afghanistan was also not in the favor of conquering countries. And so over time, it has really been referred to as the graveyard of empires. And so both of those two reasons were from an objective perspective would have caused us to have caution and question why we would go get involved. And then also we need to question how the situation arose in Afghanistan with the rise of Al-Qaeda and then later on with the rise of ISIS, where we saw the recent attacks yesterday. And the way that I see what's happening is there's this conflict and there's also this business of conflict. So while we were in Afghanistan, a lot of people say we wasted $2 trillion. This money was not worth anything to us because after 20 years, we're still leaving the Taliban in charge. But we need to also recognize that that money didn't disappear. It was used by defense contractors and security teams, as well as the U.S. military. And so we were essentially there, and I argue in this article that you're talking about, that we were just there as a security force. It was really pathetic to me that we were even there in that capacity, that we didn't even get the mineral rights. We, like, the government of Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan didn't want to do business with us. And so there we are essentially as a security force, because the other companies in the other countries which have these mineral concessions did not want to provide security. And we, as the United States government, were happy to oblige in that way.
So I think most of my listeners would agree with your assessments. But for listeners, I always assume I have a newbie listener that may have bought in to the line that, yes, this was all about establishing democracy and it was all about human rights. If they're unfamiliar with this mineral extraction aspect, could you please go over that for them briefly?
Sure. So the way that mining and extraction works is that there's different types of geological surveys that are done, and that can be done by looking from aerial photography. It can also be done by doing different types of testing. And so based off of that surveying process, you can assess what types of minerals are beneath the surface. For example, even if you're looking at geographical maps, even from Google Earth, you can see if there's potential possibilities for natural gas and oil in various situations. And there can also see, because of those geological formations, you're also able to see the possibility of specific minerals. And you also base that off of where other minerals have already been found and what the possibility of other minerals. And so when we already went in 2001, we knew there was minerals there. And by 2010, 2011, the government had wanted to, of Afghanistan, really wanted to develop those minerals because it would provide income to the country and also help to jumpstart the economy, which has not really been able to diversify to be beneficial to the people there. And so there is over $1 trillion worth of mineral concessions, and that's what their value is. There may be more in terms of iron, copper, gold, and lithium. Lithium is really important because we use it for renewable energy. Many renewable energy sources, such as wind power and solar panels, require rare earth minerals in the form of lithium. So even if we move away from fossil fuels, such as hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and coal, we're still going to need some type of extraction to continue with the development of solar panels. And so those types of rare earth minerals, including copper, are also found in Afghanistan. And so what I saw happening was that back then, when those concessions were sold, when the Chinese were coming in, when there was concessions sold and there was outreach done to other countries, including China and India, the Americans really had no part in that. And so for me, and you know, just not just completely stepping away from the idea of law and sovereignty, but from a business perspective, why would we go in there and provide security for other people's, other countries' minerals? If our country's companies aren't even having those rights, like, why are we even there from a transnational perspective? Especially, why would we be trying to provide security for other for other transnational companies that compete with our transnational companies. So from a business perspective, that would just blew my mind. Like, just forget all of the invasion, the bombing and the drones and all, like, forget all of that. From a business perspective, that was just outrageous to me that we would take our military forces and even if somebody doesn't hold the U.S. military in esteem, I think they still can recognize that there is a certain power and value that the U.S. Military provides. And I felt that resource was being squandered in this way by providing security protection for other countries' mineral rights.
What would you say, just to play devil's advocate, if there is someone listening that still buys this idea that the incursion into Afghanistan was all about spreading democracy rather than acting as security guards for these foreign mining companies, what would you tell them? What are the main pieces of evidence you would give them to support your argument?
Well, so this op-ed that I wrote was actually a response to a number of articles and statements that I had seen from various different legal institutions and organizations that were essentially saying, you know, we're very concerned about the demise of the rule of law, the demise of democracy in Afghanistan. But where were they when the United States was killing civilians? And if you just look at the numbers that are there, it's startling that that about 500,000 people have been killed post 9/11 in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan by the wars that have been fought through the U.S. military. And so this number also is underestimated, and there's other conflict that has arisen as a result of that. So there's this humanitarian toll. And so our way of responding to conflict and the way to bend people to our political will in the United States has been through specific and targeted military invasions or through the use of economic sanctions. And prior to 9/11, there was economic sanctions that were placed on Iraq. And that was a way essentially to get access to the country. And Iraq itself was another disaster from an economic and business perspective for the United States, because the oil that would be accessed was so, the price was so low that it wasn't competitive with other markets. And so even if they had like good oil in the sense the quality was good, the cost of it was not competitive to have generate high levels of profit. And so I think that we're seeing that there's this business of war and this business of conflict. And so that's really where the benefit lies for companies. And so these companies also invest heavily in the American political process in the form of lobbying, whether it's military contractors, oil and gas lobbyists. And so they have more of a say in the political process because they spend more money and have more access to various politicians. And so that's why you've been able to have this conflict in Afghanistan drag on for 20 years, because there's companies and economic interests that have bought politicians to continue these excursions.
I think the sanctions point is very important because, you know, if we're truly concerned about the Afghan people, right, if we're concerned about, for instance, women and girls, which is the line we're hearing a lot now in the news media with the return of the Taliban, you know, the State Department freezing $9.5 billion of Afghan money in U.S.-controlled banks, as you point out in your article, this is only going to be starving civilians. You know, these sanctions aren't going to help the Afghan people.
Yeah, starvation is basically the tool that the United States uses when it doesn't want to use military force. And starvation as foreign policy has not led us in a good spot. And what we see now is really the backlash to starvationist foreign policy. And so this applies not just in Afghanistan, but we also see that we've seen this play out in Latin America, especially in Venezuela. We also see this in Yemen and Iran. And so this type of foreign policy that let's just starve people is not going to work. It's also not in our best interests because we try to use we try to break people, and the way that we do that is by starving them. And there's concerns about why, for example, the U.S. didn't respond to conflict that was happening in Rwanda because there was not the type of minerals that were available in other parts of the Middle East. And so I think we really have to question why is all this money being spent on the military? Because of that excess money that's being spent on the military, we're not able to have proper social services at home.
So in regards to what can be done now, I mean, I think after the events of yesterday and the attack in Kabul, what can be done to help the people in Afghanistan going forward?
So it has to be done in at least two ways. The first one is that from a point of integrity, we should open our borders to refugees from Afghanistan who have helped us because we put them in harm's way for them to support our projects that we were doing there. And so I think as a preliminary point for us to have an integrity and as well as for us to have any standing on the world stage, it would be imperative for us to accept refugees from Afghanistan versus having them dumped in other countries. Because this is a problem we create and we can't go through that problem at other countries' doors. And then as a second matter, I think that we should recognize the sovereignty of various countries. So we had a president in power for the past 4 years that half of the country did not like, but we didn't see countries that were coming in to invade us or do different types of excursions because we don't like the government there. So I think that the same way other countries were patient with us, we also need to be patient with other countries in terms of how we conduct diplomacy, and we should conduct diplomacy. We should not do a lot of backhand dealings and backdoor deals.
I just wanted to add to that. I feel as if one of the things that scares me about how U.S. foreign policy is carried out now is it seems like we've forgotten that we have diplomacy within the toolbox of things we can use. And, you know, we almost immediately jump towards sanctions or other forms of warfare.
Yeah, and one of the things I completely don't get is why we have this very hostile posture towards China. China has actually, you know, I also do research in the area of renewable energy. China has really moved ahead of us in the renewable energy space. And the reason is just because they haven't been spending all, you know, a big chunk of their national defense on the military operations in other countries. And so all this money that we have been spent fighting wars, if we had spent that money on climate change adaptation, we would be in a better space than we are now, and we would have more credibility on the international stage. And so if we cannot criticize China for doing essentially the same thing we do 10 times worse on steroids. And so I think we need to have some accountability and respect for what we've done, and also seek out to reconcile versus trying to just go in with the upper hand like we have done for the past 200 years. And the same way we accepted refugees after World War II, it's important that as we move away from the wars that started in response to 9/11, that we also accept refugees as well.
There were just one or two more questions I had. In regards to the events we've seen unfolding in Afghanistan, I thought it was very interesting. You point out in the article, this op-ed, that I mean, we've seen, you know, people falling from these military plane evacuations. And it does kind of bring to mind 20 years ago, the World Trade Center. Could you talk about that contrast?
Yeah, and so after 9/11, we saw that people in the desperation that they were experiencing as a result of the crumbling of the Twin Towers, they were jumping to their deaths because there was smoke and the buildings were crumbling. And so for all of us, as we were watching that was just harrowing, like to see that happening. And then we saw the same type of, that was actually the first time I ever saw somebody fall from a building when that happened. And then I hadn't really seen it again until recently, where when we saw folks falling from the planes of the US military evacuations. And so I felt that why are people falling from the sky? And I think the conflict that surrounds that is not going away. And we really need to go in, like you said, and use that diplomatic toolbox. And if we want to do that, we have to really go to the table as honest brokers and not try to starve people so that they can bend to our will. And I think that's really an important starting place for us to be at.
And also, you talk a little bit about some very harrowing stats from the Watson Institute. You know, these wars, and I think people miss this sometimes, but you get at it in this op-ed. I mean, these wars cause massive displacement of people. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, and I think what we have to do is we have to do a cost-benefit analysis in how we're going to bring about our democracy from the U.S. and its rule of law systems over to other countries, and what that's actually going to have a cost in terms of human lives. And so, you know, we've seen, you know, 500,000 children died as a result of U.S. economic sanctions in Iraq. We also see, you know, millions of people that are being impacted and displaced. And is it really worth it in terms of being able to provide our way of life and impose it on other people when there's clearly a rejection of it? And then one thing I also wanted to share with you is this idea that we are building democracy and the rule of law. What I have actually seen is the exact opposite. So, for example, our carceral system that we have in the United States that incarcerates over 2 million people in our country, we've taken this rule of law, criminal justice / injustice system and exported it. So over the past 40 years, as our prison population has increased 500%, there's also been an increase in prison populations in other countries. So even though we're head and shoulders above other countries in terms of the number of people we have incarcerated, especially among what's considered the first world OECD countries, what really strikes me is that we've done various rule of law initiatives through the State Department, as well as the American Bar Association, where we've taken our system of carcerality and exported it to other countries. So we've taken what we're doing wrong and try to ship it overseas as rule of law and democracy initiatives. And so that's the same thing that we see happening here, because even our economic system that exploits labor, exploits the environment, that's what we're exporting. We're not exporting democracy and the rule of law.
And I just wanted to add too, I think you'll agree with this. I think something that's been missed in the current conversations we're seeing about Afghanistan is that, you know, the previous Afghan government wasn't exactly it was pretty corrupt in a lot of ways under Ghani. And as you point out in the article, the backlash we see to that is essentially a narco state.
Yeah, and I think that in some places it's even been described as a narco-terrorist state, but I don't want to go in and describe it that way because I want to at least assess the situation as it is. But definitely, it's really like seeing the way a cartel operates. And so I think to really legitimize the state, and I do think, like, I am hopeful that we will be in a better place. But I think what it will require is not having the U.S. be the chief broker of peace, And I think having people being able to recognize their own sovereignty and be able to create their own rule of law systems, there is a clear concern for the violations of women's rights and the rights of minorities in Afghanistan under the rule of the Taliban. But there was also a concern of the rights of civilians being killed during the U.S. occupation. And so we really have to have some truth and reconciliation happening. And I think in that way we can move forward. I also think that civil society in Afghanistan has really progressed in the last 20 years. And so while we are seeing images of people walking away and leaving the country or trying to leave it in desperation, we are also seeing people, you know, being willing to work and evolve. But I think that we have to give them time, and we should definitely not be trying to starve them as they're trying to work through their democracy.
Well, starving them will only set back Afghanistan farther. It won't be helping at all. And I guess the last thing I wanted to mention was, you know, I think right now we're seeing just, you know, if you turn on the television, sometimes you'll even see George W. Bush on the screen now talking about why the withdrawal was so bad. And I'm thinking to myself, why are we listening to George W. Bush, the person who got us into this war and, you know, has caused a lot of damage due to this war? What would you say about, you know, the media coverage and just the inability I think a lot of people in America have when it comes to addressing our own complicity in the crisis facing Afghanistan today?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And really, why are people, like, I agree, why are people listening to George W. Bush right now? Because he lied his way into this mess. And President Biden actually did the right thing by walking away from it, even if it wasn't done as neatly as it possibly could have been. But then it's very difficult also to anticipate what would happen. And I think the sooner the withdrawal happens, the better it will be. But what I would caution people about is that if the U.S. continues, if it, you know, says it's going to walk away but still tries to interfere, we're going to end up with another situation like we had in Syria, whereas it would better if we have moved towards a situation like we have in, say, Uzbekistan. And so I think that we need to work to really improve the economy in Afghanistan, so women have the ability to study and go to school and work and have a safe place to live. But to do that, it's essential that people be able to eat, and we can't starve them.
Real quick, too, I just wanted to get your take on this. One thing I hear whenever people like us criticize the use of military force and sanctions in places like Afghanistan by the U.S. is that, oh, you're just an isolationist. You don't want the U.S. to be involved with the world. How do you respond to those types of criticisms, which those types of criticisms, in my view, I feel are very dishonest and not charitable?
Yeah, I think that the criticism of isolationism is that they have a warped view of what actually constitutes isolationism. The actual idea of being connected to people and being connected to businesses in other countries is actually doing commerce with them, not engaging in tactics that try to kill them and starve them. And so I think that's the way we should, you know, conduct and be connected to the world. So I think there's this rise of globalization that is happening. And so the winners of the globalization, so even if you're, you know, if you're not in favor of globalization, but just being able to recognize and see that the winners of globalization are really the countries and the companies that are able to work and do business. And so the Chinese have really mastered this. They have a different way of doing business. And so I think that we need to learn. We need to learn what other countries are doing successfully, and really those who are criticizing and not seeing the reality of what has happened really just need to shut up.
Well, I want to thank you, Nadia Ahmed, for coming on Parallax Views. And I appreciate the op-ed you wrote, because I'm also, you know, just sick and tired of some of the lamer takes we're seeing across the media sphere. I think we need to have a really thoughtful conversation rather than a, you know, tabloid style soundbite news, or, you know, tabloid style soundbite non-news, I would say at this point. But for my listeners, how can they keep up with your work? And is there anything you want to say in closing to people who are concerned about the situation in Afghanistan?
So I think right now what's really critical, at least what we can do in the United States, is really pressure our members of Congress as well as the White House to accept refugees. I think that's really critical. And I think we should also address issues of sanctions and really speak out about sanctions and how they have really been detrimental to our foreign policy and the effects they have on other countries. I think being outspoken in that respect is really crucial. If folks want, they can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Nadia, N-A-D-I-A, B as in boy, and then A-H-M-A-D. And so I think it's just really important to also just follow the independent media. I don't watch the cable news. And so don't even let that trash enter your headspace.
And thank you very much once again, Nadia Ahmad, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Trita Parsi of the great Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. All of you listeners who have been listening to me for some time now know that I am a big fan of Quincy and a huge supporter of the work they are doing. And also, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Nadia Ahmad about Afghanistan. As always, if you can, consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Your support is what will keep this show going. I am working at a breakneck pace, and I need you to help out if you can by supporting me at the $1, $5, $10, or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. More content to come before the end of the month on the Patreon page at the $5 and above tiers. And also at the $10 and $15 tiers, you get the producer's credit shout out, which brings us to producer's credit shout outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The Warnerd, Amelia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Brian S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at my Patreon page at the $10 or $15 tiers. Patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.